financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
There's actually literature backing this up that therapists are in a helping profession and they feel shame about profiting. And so they have this discomfort with the fact that they have to charge. And it's so uncomfortable for them that it's then really hard for them when their clients bring up topics of money and fees. And so many therapists just avoid it. It's like, we will leave money conversations outside the room. Good luck. You're on your own to figure that out. Unfortunately, that's how it goes sometimes.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. And our guest today is Joyce Labaugh. I'm just going to sit back and learn stuff. That's what I'm going to do.
Well, we're both learning stuff. I love to have her on as a guest because she's got this tie between the emotional side and the financial side. And that's where we sit as well, only she has all these designations after her name. I have PhD. She has like a list after her name, right? Will you tell us about your designation?
Sure. So I first got the Certified Financial Planner designation because I wanted to go into financial planning and I loved that.
CFP.
And then, CFP, right? And then I really wanted to be able to specialize working with the ultra high net worth. And to do that, you really need a solid foundation in tax. So then I got a graduate degree in tax law. And I read a lot of tax code and a lot of Supreme Court cases.
I love it. Yep.
Such a nerd. Yes. And then when I made my career change and went back to study counseling to become a therapist, I got a master's degree in counseling as well. So I've got CFP, MTax, and MA, which is my master's in counseling. And then I'm also a licensed therapist. And that's a set of letters. LPC, MH is the set that I have right now.
Interesting. So I say that sometimes I'm an education junkie and I love to meet people who just love to, oh, there's something new. Let's learn about that. You know, maybe that will be interesting. So bravo. I'm just so happy to see somebody with credentials talking about this topic, especially about money, because as you point out, a lot of therapists not only don't want to talk about money, but I can tell you from experience that we have an inordinately high number of clients who are therapists or in the mental health field. And I've done a study, a one-by-one study, asking each one of them when they come on board, why do you think this is? Why do you think we have so many people in the mental health field? And the best answer I heard was from a Harvard grad, actually. And she was pretty young, but she said, I think we're used to asking for help. We understand how to ask for help. And we're not really good with money. We're busy helping other people, running a business, and most of us aren't very good at even running our business. There's the insurance collection and all this sort of thing. And I thought that was a very quick and very articulate answer.
While I was getting my graduate degree in counseling, I did a research project on fee structures that therapists use. And part of that, I really got to understand therapists' attitude toward fees and money. And similar to what your informal study has shown, what I learned, there's actually literature backing this up, that there's a lot of factors, but one of them that's really strong is therapists are in a helping profession and they feel shame about profiting in the helping profession. That if I'm here to help people, then it cheapens it if I'm also making money. And so they have this discomfort with the fact that they have to charge. And it's so uncomfortable for them that it's then really hard for them when their clients bring up topics of money and fees, because it brings up the therapist's own discomfort with fees. And so many therapists just avoid it. It's like, we will leave money conversations outside the room. Good luck. You're on your own to figure that out. Unfortunately, that's how it goes sometimes.
You know, that's really fascinating. Even I'm getting a little insight into my own psyche at the moment, because I come from a family that had, no money. And I always wanted to help people with money from the time I started working with John Hancock. But I'm in an industry that loves to capitalize on however much product they can sell somebody and the large commissions that are made on it. And I don't feel good about that. And so I had to develop this system that we have now, which is subscription-based, where you can get financial wellness tools for a small amount of money monthly, right? And I have lowered my fees, unlike probably any company, right? I keep lowering my fees and making it more accessible until now there's not even any contract. It's just on a month by month basis. You enroll. And what I've learned is that people just stay because they're happy and because they're getting results, not because they were boxed into something. And I just never wanted to add to the problem of money and managing money. And so I personally am faced sometimes with people who I know really can't afford our services, but who really need our services. And I have to try and find a way to meet that middle ground where I'm not being taken advantage of. They're getting the help they need, and everybody's okay with it. And it's taken a lot of years to finesse that. So thanks for this therapy session, Joy.
Well, as you're sharing that story, Frances, I'm hearing your values, and I'm hearing how you've brought your business, structured your business to align with your values, right? Because what I'm hearing you say is
That's right.
that you recognize you need to make a living, and also that you value accessibility, it sounds like. You value helping people, and that it sounds like there's a value of fairness as well, to a certain extent, that you're not just making as much money as you can because you can. But there's a fairness piece, it sounds like, as well. And so I feel like I hear you share how you've adjusted your business model to really be in alignment with your values.
Yeah, this show really isn't about me, but I can't resist sharing this one little tidbit with you right now. We recently started offering Hug Your Money as a group benefit. And the first group coming on board is a school. And I just, adult students. And I just love the fact that we are able to scale this. You know, this is 217 students, all of whom will get access to these kinds of tools with the kind of support that I wanted to give. And I wouldn't have said that at all if you hadn't brought up my values. But it made me realize, yeah, we just went through a lot of work and expense and time to get this ready because I felt good about it, right? It does come into play. You can't possibly remove your emotions completely from your monetary decisions, your financial decisions.
Absolutely. And I think this really gets to a wise statement someone said to me once, and they said, whether you realize it or not, we're
That's
making
right.
decisions based on emotions. And so the key, if we want to be really ch sharp, savvy decision makers, is to get curious about what the emotion is, and to see it and recognize it. And that way we're not just reflexively acting, but we can acknowledge it, and then we can act with intention and make decisions.
I mean,
Yeah, I
as
think.
far as I can think, I mean, I think every decision you ever make is based on emotions. So, you know,
Well, we aren't
Joy,
robots.
no, exactly.
Not yet, anyway.
Can
Yeah.
I say something real quick about Frances
Course.
too? She and I have talked about this and have done projects together. And not only do I think that the Hug Your Money and the product she offers are a great benefit. Any business would be smart to try to incorporate that somehow. But Frances also has the benefit, like she said, the first client is a school. And she and I talk often about the fact that, you know, young people just don't get an education or a proper one about handling money, you know?
Jay and I just did a cartoon called Pablo the Pirate Cat, in which Jay is the voice of the
She's sitting
cat.
right behind Frances.
It's
Can you see him?
Pablo.
I got to be
Pablo.
Pablo,
Yeah,
Pablo's
Pablo.
voice. And
That
it
is
was for
delightful.
5 to 11-year-olds to teach them basic things about money in fun ways, like using jelly beans and things of that nature. And so we're working on a tweener right now. He's a little cooler with a bandana and some skateboard tricks. But yeah, just, you know, if I would love to be able to get people at a younger age even to understand this so that it doesn't, they don't drag it around their whole lives. I mean, yeah, I would love to hear what you think about strategies that you offer to people or strategies that you suggest to reduce stress and help with their alignment of money.
Sure. So before you asked me that, I was going to ways you can help children. So that's where my mind went. But
Oh, well, please do. Well, remember the
oh,
question.
yeah.
Tell us how to help children. I would love that.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, so I love that it sounds like the resource you're creating. And another resource that's available for free is, this is one Vanguard created. It's called My Home Economy, and it's an app parents can download that at various ages of the children, you adjust it. And it's a way of teaching children financial literacy by incorporating it into the home. Like, essentially, you give your kid chores and you pay them for it. But as they get older, they introduce more complex financial topics. So I just wanted to offer that resource.
Thank you. We covered that partly in that cartoon as well. We used spend, save, and share jars so that they would learn to apportion their money. But we did cover, budgeting, interest, but all in ways that kids would understand. You know,
Right.
instead of saying, let's build a budget, we're saying, sometimes Pablo makes a plan before he spends all of his gold. Certainly, we're not the only resource for teaching children either, but I wanted to get something out there. And
Yeah.
I called Jay and he said he was willing to do it. And it's a video book. So back to my question, though, and thank you for that little segue. And I would love for parents to anything we can do to facilitate the conversation between parents and teachers and children so that the next generation actually has the tools they need to use those different values, different ideas they have, but to be able to implement what they want to and not have it be another thing they end up, forgive me, Joy, in therapy over. Okay. So strategies that you might recommend to help people lower stress. Let's take them separately, lower stress things and then maybe align with their wealth.
Yeah, so lowering stress, I think one thing that can be really helpful is just to pause a moment and get curious with yourself. So it could even be like it can be when you're noticing stress. Can you take a minute or two? And I encourage people to just focus where in their body do they feel that stress? Bring their attention there and get curious with it. And sometimes we start to learn things about ourselves. And you might feel a little bit weird at first. Thoughts might come to mind, images might come to mind. Just go with it, right? It all, you know, it's
Mindfulness.
yes. And when we bring curiosity to it, we can learn things about our relationship with money. So, for example, you're feeling stressed about a purchase you need to make or your purchase you're considering making. Carve out a few minutes and check in with your body about where you feel the tension, the stress, and just really explore that. And you can even ask it questions like, what are you stressed about? What are you afraid is going to happen? What are you hoping is going to happen? And like through this, you start to learn somewhat what some of your values are. So I think I mentioned earlier about like my values around money is it means safety and security for me. And the way I learned that is when I was facing a purchase I needed to make that was I felt very, very stressed about. I got curious with myself, like, what am I afraid would happen? And I was like, oh, I'm afraid that I'm going to end up, I'm going to die alone on the side of the road with no money. And it was like, this is like a $200 purchase. It feels like my reaction feels a little stronger than it's actually warranted here. But this is the beauty of when we are curious with ourselves is we learn what's actually going on, right? And that it wasn't just about the $200. It's about, oh, to me, money is about safety and security. And so I encourage people to recognize that when you're feeling stress or anxiety around money, this is an opportunity to understand yourself more deeply. If you can give yourself a little space and time to be with those fears, with those anxieties, and get curious with them, you're going to learn more about yourself and your relationship with money. And just that awareness alone can help reduce stress, and it can bring a little bit more calm and a little bit more peace.
I tend to tell people, give yourself a little gut check. But the second thing I tell people is figure out what your worst scenario is. What's the worst that can happen? If you can live with that, then you can calm down about this decision. The worst that can happen is you're going to lose 10% of your money, or you're going to not be able to make that car payment. Okay, what's your plan? What's your exit strategy? If you get into too much car and you can't make that car payment, what are you going to do about it? And I find that when people figure it out, they say, well, I'll just get a second job, or I'll sell some stuff, or I'll sell the car, or whatever their plan is. Once they figure out how to address the final ugly money monster problem, right, then they feel better about making the decision. But also along the way, a lot of times people don't like what they discover and they think, oh, yeah, the worst case scenario is something I'm not very happy about. I'm not willing to do that. But that informs their decision, and then they make a decision, they make some adjustments to make the decision more wisely in a way that's more comfortable for them.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And another thing that I've also encouraged people to do sometimes is so you don't have to wait till you're feeling stressed, you can actually just imagine a room full of money and notice how you feel about it. That can tell you a lot. Do you feel excited? Do you feel scared? And like, and then explore it. Excited, why? Because what will that mean to you? Oh, you get to take a lot of trips. You get to do all these things. Like, okay, maybe freedom and independence is what this value is. Maybe you feel scared because it's like, I've got this room full of money and I'm afraid it's all going to go away. Like, okay, right? It's giving you data around yourself. So, that's just another thing that I've encouraged people to explore sometimes on their own.
That is really insightful. I recently had a client who inherited a lot of money. They'd never had money. They didn't know what was coming. It was a total shock to her. But we talked about her values and why is this such a problem for her? And she didn't just win the lottery. The way she sees it is she has a huge sense of responsibility now that she didn't have before. When she had almost no money, but she could pay her bills and go out to eat once a week, she was fine. It was easy to manage. She never expected to have any more. All of a sudden, this influx of money comes in. She's saying, "Oh my gosh, I mean, this kind person left me all this money. I didn't know they were going to leave it to me. And they worked so hard for it. So now it's my responsibility to make sure that I do everything properly with it and I don't have any of these skills." It was awful for her. Nobody would believe that, but really very hard for her to do. Go ahead.
I love that you're sharing this story because I think for people who don't have a lot of money, that they're like, "What? How? What do you mean, rich people problems?" Right?
I
But I
know.
love this story that you shared because it really illustrates how money can feel like a burden, and then you have that responsibility, and what do you do with it, and how do you handle it? And so what I love about that story is the way you were able to meet her with compassion and really see her perspective from her point of view and meet her in that. And I think that's really beautiful and important. And that's how we can help create change with people in their relationship with money.
Let's take
Thanks.
another quick break if we can. Francis, can we get your phone number, please?
Of course, it's 413-773-3333.
And please feel free to visit hugyourmoney.com. We will be back with more financial fitness with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and Joy Slabaugh. This is a very enjoyable show.
I don't think I've made it any secret that I wish financial advisors were trained a little differently than they are trained, than I was trained in the beginning, right? And that story that we had just before the break about someone inheriting a lot of money and having it really worry her. I mean, she wasn't sleeping at night, nothing, you know, really stressed, really stressed. I was worried for her. And she was telling me stories that there are people who will prey on someone who has money. And most of us aren't ever given a skill set to know the difference. And so we don't know if the nice person telling us that this is what we should do is the right move to make or not. And the best we can do is trust our gut. And that is very hard when you're stressed or when you feel like you're in a place of urgency. So I would say, since you gave us such great advice about, you know, how to sort of step back and check your body for stress, when somebody's in a situation of crisis management for finance and they have to act rather urgently, or at least they feel that they have to act urgently, what advice would you give somebody in that situation?
Yeah, and so there's a couple ways I can go with this question. Like, you mean about as far as like how to find a financial advisor who's not going to prey on you? Is that what you mean?
No, because I think that, well, yes, you can give us that. Absolutely. That would be lovely to hear. But it wasn't where I was headed. But yes, please do tell us that.
Well, one thing that I would encourage folks is talk to at least three people. That way you get a sense of the different flavors that are out there. Ask them about their fees, and they should be very clear and upfront with you about their fees. And if they're not, run for the hills. That is not someone you want to work with. I also encourage people to find people who have serious credentials. And so if you talk to at least three people, your spidey senses will be able to tell you who feels better than the others around these. And that's a great way to I think to narrow down and find someone who's a good fit.
But also, money is very personal. And do you really think they're listening to you? Are they asking questions about your life, not just your dollars? For me, that's how I would want to choose somebody. Are they really interested in providing what I need? Or are they, is this just what they know how to do? Here's the illustration, sign the dotted line, next. I would add to that, because of what I've learned and why we built Hug Your Money, that if all they're talking to you about is your investments, not your budget, not your debt, not your life, not your goals, not your kids, I think that's a flag. I know that's what they're trained to do, but that's my point. You don't need people trained to do that. You need people trained to help you, right?
Right. And because investments are only helpful for you if they align with the rest of your life. And if the person's not asking about your life and your dreams and your goals, then how can you trust that the advice they're going to give you is going to help you reach your goals and dreams? And this is the piece about bringing money in alignment with your values. Ideally, you want to work with an advisor who is upfront about their values and is going to help you explore your values and then help you bring your money in alignment with that. Because this is how money can be a tool, right? It can be a tool for harm and oppression and all sorts of terrible things. And it can be a tool for bringing your dreams to life, enabling connection with the people that you love, for having impact in your community and even beyond. And so find someone that you vibe with who gets that, and then they can help you understand your values and bring them to life with your money.
Yeah, I think I also want to point out that, you know, I've been doing this since I was 23. And I started the debt portion, the budget portion, all of that 18 years ago. And one thing I will say is that pretty much everyone in the financial industry will talk to you about investments. Some may talk to you about a budget. But even if you don't have much money, the idea of getting rid of your debt in some responsible way that you feel good about, right? Or accelerating the payoff of your debt, as we do here, is life-changing. I've never met a financial advisor, when I showed this to them, that didn't say that changes everything in retirement because you're not depleting your assets, you're not doing that. Your asset dollars are going to last you longer, all of that. So what I would say is, if you're asking questions of a financial advisor, ask them about your debt and see what they say. If they just say, well, take some money out of your 401k because you're going to pay yourself back and it's a lower interest rate, you're getting the same cookie cutter advice you could get from your hairdresser. No insult to hairdressers, but they're not trained in finance typically. Then I think, you know, you need to dig a little bit deeper into that piece. And I think it's terribly underserved when it comes to financial wealth, that even if you don't have much money, you can improve your situation drastically by watching your budget and your debt piece. And I just don't think we're talking about it in the industry very much. I mentioned the hairdresser and I saw you smile. You're going to tell me about where people ask for help, I bet. Where do people ask for financial help from?
Yeah, when I was at Vanguard, I led a research project to understand where do people get referrals for financial advisors. And I was stunned to learn that one of the top things, the places people go, is their hairdresser. Yeah. That's one of their most trusted advisors. And if their hairdresser says something, then they follow it or gives them a referral, they follow it.
If there's just one thing that you wish all financial advisors were taught, what mm-hmm. would you hope that is?
I really wish they were all taught before any client engagement, whether it's a phone call or an appointment, to take a few minutes to themselves, calm themselves, recognize what they're feeling, calm themselves, set that aside so they can then engage with their client coming from a place, come from calm compassion. I believe that is a game changer for the advisor. They can hear more clearly. They can hear more fully what the client is saying. And it's also a game changer for the clients, because when you get to interact with someone who's coming from a place of calm compassion, it feels wonderful. And then you're not getting this agenda. You're not getting the things we don't like as much about the financial industry. You're not going to get those when people are coming from a place of calm compassion. So this is a really small thing that literally any advisor can do. It just takes 1 to 3 minutes before a client engagement and can be make a really big difference in themselves, their clients, the client relationship, and success for the advisor and the client.
I love that piece of advice. It's not what I thought you were going to say, but I love it. Are you listening, advisors? Do this.
Calm down.
Just do it. Yeah, I think, you know, if you're dragging your baggage into those meetings, you're doing a disservice for your clients. You have to be clear-minded, separated from things, even if it means you're in front of the client and you have to say, I'm really sorry, I'm having a terrible day. I'm going to be right back. Even if you have to reset. But, you know, people trust us with their livelihoods and their lives to get them to goals and things of that nature. I think we should earn that trust. And I absolutely think it should begin with some kind of compassion and an open ear and listening. You know, I don't like that approach that you're going to get from some people particularly when they're trying to impress you with jargon or lingo and make you feel like you don't know what you're talking about, so you should just trust them. My golden rule is you should never buy anything you don't understand. And I don't care how complex it is, any advisor worth their weight should be able to tell you in totally accessible language so that you can repeat it back to them, which I ask people to do. Tell me what you think I just said. Okay. That's what you should be able to do. You should understand these complex financial products, and your advisor should be able to tell you in language you can understand. You don't need to hear them babble about the intrinsic value of a stock. You need to understand what's going to happen if the market changes, or what's going to happen if somebody dies, what's going to happen if you want to get to your money. Those are easy answers to get if someone will talk to you in a way that is certainly respectful and not talking down to you. That just irritates me when I see people that say, "Well, I've got this guy, I never understand what he says, but whatever he tells me, I just do it."
Well, and this is like, let's put advisors on notice, right? So if your advisor is not treating you with respect, care, and compassion, and they're not using accessible language, I have good news for you. You don't have to put up with poor treatment from your advisors or mediocre service from your advisors. There's a new cadre is emerging that can really meet you where you are.
Well, we're betting on it here at Hug Your Money, I'll tell you, because that's exactly what we're scaling up for, is that sort of thing. Yeah, we're really almost out of time. So I do want to thank you, Joy, so much for joining us again. And this is a conversation I would have over and over again. I just think any information we can get out there to the public about, if you want to call it permission to challenge your advisor and to look at yourself more closely about your money and just put the fear, the guilt, the shame to the side. Your insights really remind us that money isn't just a tool. It's a mirror. It's a stressor. It's a symbol. And sometimes it's a path to healing. So, we'll be sure to share your resources and let people know how they can connect with you and your work. But thank you once again for joining us, Joy.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you,
Our
Joy.
pleasure.
Francis, can we get your phone number one more
Of
time?
course. 413-773-3333.
And as always, hugyourmoney.com is a great resource too. Join us again next time for another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Rand.
I almost asked if you could do a voice for the Money Monster.
Oh, a voice of the money monster.
Oh, it's the money monster. I've
Yeah.
come to take it all.
That's
Oof.
great.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. It's where you belong. Your future's waiting, steady and strong. Dignity shines. Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
What do I think about money and believe about money and feel about money can be really helpful to start to get curious. And what are the messages that I've received about money? What do I think is true about money? What do I think is good about money, is bad about money? And just getting curious about this is really a way that we can understand more richly ourselves and how we are interacting with others and the assumptions we're bringing to our engagements with others.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the money doctor, Francis Ram. Hello, we have a guest.
We have a lovely guest. We have Joy Slabaugh with us again. Joy is especially interesting to me as a guest because she's a licensed therapist and a former CFP and the creator of Relational Wealth Framework. That, you know, how many times have people asked me, you know, are you half marriage coach and half financial coach, right? But that to me is very interesting. So, you know, we're going to get all touchy-feely about money and talk about the emotional root of financial decisions, all the stuff that really hamstrings us when we're making financial choices. So she describes her work as living at the intersection of wealth, well-being, and impact, which I think is incredibly accurate. So welcome, Joy, back to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. Let's talk first about the relational wealth framework. You coined that phrase. Can you teach us what that means?
Yeah, I really think of this as about our relationship with money and how money impacts our relationships with others. So I think of it as there's an internal relationship, how we think about our money, and then there's our relationship externally with others and the way money impacts that. So I really think about this as inviting people to think, to consider both sides of this. And as we do that, this is really where we can start to see shifts in our relationship with money and how it impacts others. And that's where we get to experience more connection, more authentic connection with others, and a more impactful life as well.
That word relationship. I think in the forward to one of my books, Chris Collins, actually, who's no longer with us, a great guy, but he had written the forward and he said, when did my love-hate relationship with money begin?
Yeah, well, we live in a capitalistic culture where money makes the world go round and money impacts all of us, whether we realize it or not. And so this relationship with money is sometimes one we're not aware of, that we don't even think about what money means to us and how we feel about money. Or it can be a very intentional one where we become aware of how we think and feel about money and our attitudes toward money. So again, whether we're aware of it or not, we all have a relationship with money. Because we live in the culture that we do and we grew up in the whatever family we grew up with, we tend to absorb beliefs and attitudes from what's around us. And so this can really shape our relationship with money in ways we may or may not be aware of. And so this can be a positive or it can be a negative or something in between as well. And so what I find just really fascinating is the way money impacts us and our attitudes and our values. And I really can talk about this all day long with people because it's just so interesting to me. And so again, I refer to it as a relationship with money, but it's like everything that we think and feel around money. So like an example for me is that one of my values around money is, to me, it represents safety and security. I find when I chat with people, we all have different money values. Oftentimes when you talk with people, it's either safety and security, or it is about freedom and independence, or it is about connection with friends and family, or some combination of this. And the safety and security one is really, really strong with me. And that has had a lot of impact and influences on how I live my life and how I engage with money. And that this used to be something that I was not really aware of. I just kind of did my thing. And I was like, yeah, I'm somebody who really values saving, right? And then it was only as I got more curious and deeper into my own relationship with money when I realized, oh, actually, I'm treating money as a source of safety and security. So it can feel really threatening to me if I need to spend more money than I had planned. And that can feel very stressful for me. And it's not just because I'm spending more money. It's because my sense of safety and security is being eroded. So I give that as an example about how our relationship with money, whether we're aware of it or not, really can impact us in a lot of ways. And as we become aware of it, it opens up more possibilities of how we can be in this relationship and thus exist in the world.
You know, this thing with money and relationships is always interesting. All those hidden beliefs that get us, you know, I like to call it baggage. It's probably not the technical term, right? But can you give us an example of maybe a couple that you, obviously not with names, but a couple that, you know, maybe one person has one set of beliefs, another person has another set, they're on completely different pages.
Yeah, something that's really common with couples is where you often see different values is one really values saving and one really values spending. And it's really easy for these couples to end up in at, you know, loggerheads with each other,
Yes.
demonizing the other of like, oh, you're a spendthrift who doesn't care about the future, you know, and then the other one's like, well, you're a tightwad who doesn't want to have any fun, right? I'm sure you all have heard this with your own partner or friends or your parents, right?
No, never.
Right. We've heard, we know how this plays out.
Sure.
And one of the things that we is often overlooked with this is realizing that this is just about values, money values, and one is not good or bad. They're just different. And when we go a little bit deeper with people, we often find that the person who's wanting to spend is really trying to help the couple, their family, live life in the moment and not be so future oriented that they can't enjoy the present. And you find we'll find that the saver is really trying to shore up security in the future, right? That we can have fun in the future as well. And so when you when we help people get down to their core values, it's a lot easier to appreciate what the other is bringing. Well, you're of course, like I tend to be the saver person, right? When I hear that the other person is about enjoying the present, wow, that really resonates with me. And like, I really appreciate that. That's a huge value add for me that they're helping me enjoy the present, right? And then what I bring is, okay, yeah, we can plan and think for save for the future, can make sure that we're going to be okay in the future. They can bring that, I'm bringing that value add of security and stability. And so this can really take what is often a hot button topic that people fight about with their couples therapist, with their financial advisor, with each other, with the kids, right? All the time. It can actually be an opportunity for closer connection with each other. And so money really can invite us to deeper connections with each other, and understanding our own values and appreciating the values of others is a path toward that deeper connection.
It's funny,
We
Francis. I never thought about the fact that, you know, you want help with your money, but you also want help with getting along and how the two, you know, coexist or need it. You know, you may need help with both. It's a whole new business model. Joy's got it down. Do you need help with your money or do you need help with therapy? You know,
Well, the thing is that money problems show up in your relationship. And so that's where, for us, I mean, how long have we been talking about this exact thing? That's why I like to have Joy on as a guest, because she says all the things that we deal with. She says them very eloquently and from a professional standpoint, right? But one ends up being the steward of household finances. They're the one that pays the bills and handles the minutiae, and that's their role in that relationship. And the other one often we'll hand over a paycheck and say, honey, you're doing a great job. I'll see you at retirement, right? When there's a stressor that's introduced, a kid has to go to college, you know, somebody loses their job, somebody's sick, then this all just bubbles to the surface and people start pointing their fingers at each other. So one of these partners feels like they have a handle on where the money's going, but they're frustrated because they can't fix the problem. And they go to the other partner and say, we need to talk. Those terrible words, right? We need to talk. And worse than that, it's about money. And so now the sparks fly. And now the other person is feeling awful because they don't know how to solve it. They've been living in a bubble, right? They had no idea that you're just not on the same page. As often as I use that phrase, we find for the most part, it's just about doing exactly what Joy just said. Just address the get to the core of it, figure out what each person really does want. Compliment them, right? That they're both trying to do the same thing. They're living in the same household. They're on the same team. And if one of them's pulling this way and one of them's pulling that way, their wagon isn't going anywhere. So when you get them together, then everything seems to get easier. And the positive reinforcement goes a long way.
I think that's really nicely said. And it's reminding me of another type of situation where you see different money values in couples. And that's often where you see class differences. So maybe one person grew up working class and the other person grew up in an upper middle class family. Often they have very different attitudes toward money and very different ways of treating it. And I've seen all different versions of this, but this can be one that leads to so much conflict because each person grew up in one world around money. And we often tend to think that, well, of course, everyone thinks about it this way, right? But that's not the, as we know, that's not actually the case. And so it can really lead to a lot of conflict when it's really much bigger than even just the individual, right? There are class-based attitudes toward wealth that can influence us, and expectations around money and expectations around lifestyle. And so all of these things can be influencing the individual and influencing the couple and influencing their relationship in ways they may not even be aware of. And so this is where the getting curious with ourselves about what do I think about money and believe about money and feel about money can be really helpful to start to get curious. And what are the messages that I've received about money? What do I think is true about money? What do I think is good about money, is bad about money? And just getting curious about this is really a way that we can understand more richly ourselves and how we are interacting with others and the assumptions we're bringing to our engagements with others.
What do
I don't
you?
know about you, Francis, but I am learning a lot here for sure. And I'm sure people have questions, but Francis, can we get your phone number?
Of course, it's 413-773-3333.
Of course, as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. We will be back with more of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Francis Ram, and our guest, Joy. It's a joy to have Joy on.
Welcome back, Joy. So picking up on this relationship thing again, everybody wants to blame their parents. Why didn't my parents teach me about money? Why did my parents teach me awful things about money? How much of an effect do you think that plays in the way that we grow up thinking about money and how difficult it is for us to change our habits based on what we learned from our parents?
Well, this is an age-old debate in the psychology field about nature versus nurture.
Yes.
And the reality is it's both. That yes, the things our parents do and say and we witness does influence us, and it's also not permanent. That we have agency, and so we can adjust these messages. And our brains are not necessarily, don't have to be set. We can cultivate neuroplasticity, which is what allows us to form new beliefs and attitudes. So I want to offer that as hope to anyone who's maybe you recognize that your family's relationship with money was kind of warped. It doesn't have to stay that way. There are ways that you can evolve this and grow and evolve and change. You're laughing.
I love that you used warped as a professional.
It's a good word.
That their relationship with money was kind of warped. Yeah, so that brings me to a question. You are a rare combination of a therapist and a financial professional. How did that happen? There's got to be a story there, Joy.
Yeah, so I was a financial planner. I got into financial planning right after college, and I really loved it because you get to work with people. It's a lot of creative problem solving and a healthy dose of nerdy analytics, which I love. And so I thought this is the perfect career, and it was in a lot of ways. And I went on to work with extraordinarily wealthy individuals doing really fascinating, intellectually engaging work. And I also noticed that while I was helping people solve some problems, it was sometimes also creating other problems. And that it wasn't the magical cure-all. Like financial planning, I was like, okay, yes, we have their money in order, but sometimes they're still really unhappy. Sometimes they still really feel anxious or feel all sorts of ways. And so I got really curious about could there be more? And, essentially my job was to help wealthy people acquire more money. And I was like, there's got to be more to life than this. And so I, after a lot of introspection, decided to make a career change to become a therapist, specifically a trauma therapist, which is incredibly meaningful and rewarding work. And I really love this work. What I was really surprised, though, was that people were still talking to me about money. And I was like, no, I'm a therapist now. I'm not a financial planner now. And they're still talking about money. And I realized that, you know, yeah, money does bring up a lot of emotions. I'd seen that as a financial advisor, was surprised to hear it coming in with my therapy clients. At first, I was surprised. But then as I thought about it more, I was like, well, of course, where else are people going to talk about money? A lot of therapists don't like talking about money. Financial planners, a lot of them don't like talking about emotions. So for many people, there's this big question mark of where and how do I get some support navigating all these ways that money is impacting me? And so that's what then inspired me to move into the intersection of money and well-being and emotions and our psychology. And I really love this because now I feel like this work, I still sometimes do work with extraordinarily wealthy people. And I feel like I have an opportunity to help them transform their relationship with money, where they get to shift it from one of stress and isolation and help evolve it so it's a tool for connection, impact, and lasting fulfillment. And to me, this feels like a life well lived. So this is me bringing my life in alignment with my values.
I totally agree.
Joy, when you said people, it seems to me, let me put it this way, that people who have a lot more money would automatically be kind of channeled to a way to figure out how to make it work. I mean, are there people with a lot of money? It's just willy-nilly and they don't, you know, there's another professional phrase, willy-nilly.
Well, I mean, there's the financial aspect and the math and do you have your ducks in a row financially? There's that piece. But then there's this piece of imagine someone who builds a gazillion-dollar business and this is their life's work. They've poured blood, sweat, and tears into this. All of their life into this. And then they got that big buyout, private equity bought it, and they got the giant payout and the big paycheck. And now, after they've sold it, they realize that was their entire identity. And who are they now? Mm-hmm. They don't have this business. They're not building a business any longer. Who are they now? And that can actually be really disorienting for people and where they're really questioning who they are and what they're doing. I know someone who was so impacted by the equity, by the sale of their company early. They were, you know, pretty lucky that they built a really successful firm, got a buyout, and they felt adrift. And then they spent 20 years trying to figure things out, and they eventually built a new company to compete with the one that they'd sold and get a second go at it. But I share this to say that like we like to think that money is going to solve our problems and it will solve some problems. I don't want to pretend otherwise, but it also can create some problems and it can also mask other problems that when we might not realize that, oh, I'm not super clear on who I am and what my meaning is in life is because I'm so focused on amassing wealth. And then once we stop doing that or there's a big event in our life, then that's gone. And now it's like, wait, what am I doing? Who am I? What actually matters to me? And those can be really uncomfortable questions to ask and can bring up really uncomfortable emotions.
Yeah, I think the masking point is really great because when I have clients who are very wealthy, they often think, I have enough money. All I need to talk to you about is, am I making enough money? You know, am I protecting my assets? Am I making enough money? What do I do if I want to leave it to somebody? How do I tick all the boxes? Do I need a trust? Very specific monetary questions. But in reality, I find that those are the people that very often, especially if they've inherited the money, if they haven't built it from the ground up, that very often aren't really in touch with their own values. When I start asking questions like, what's important to you about this? I get answers like, well, I saw this guy who told me I should have whatever. That's not the answer to the question I asked, right? So yeah. But it is very rewarding when you can do that, when you can draw somebody out and figure out what they want. You call it wealth alignment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good term to sort of align people's values with their money. And I want you to talk a little bit more about that. But I just wanted to bring up one thing about business people who grow a business and then do something else with it and lose their identity in the mix. And one of the things that I see that's really difficult for families, and I'd love to get your take on it, is they grow a business from the ground up. They have some children. They want the business to go to the children, and they do. And the children don't really want the business. And maybe they haven't said they don't want the business, or they want it, but their perception about what they want is skewed. They think they're just getting, you know, this great thing that makes money, a license to print money. And in fact, they have to learn how to run this business. Mm-hmm. And I have this discussion with my business people who have that on their agenda, and say, you know, can you get your kids to help run it? Can you teach them how to work it? But it's almost impossible, I find, that those parents who had nothing in the beginning and have now amassed this wealth, all they want to do for their kids is not have their kids have to struggle. They just want to give them stuff. And it seems to have a counterintuitive effect in the end. Can you, maybe you disagree, but can you talk to me about that? Tell us about it.
I very much agree with you. There's actually a book I'm finishing up reading right now that talks to this exactly around how wealthy parents, the way they tend to parent and the way money enables them to parent actually can end up harming the psychological development of their children. And that the children of affluent families have higher rates of anxiety and depression than any other socioeconomic class. So there's a couple things with what you shared. Part of it is when we, as parents, of course, we don't want our children to suffer. And yet that is part of life, and learning how to tolerate discomfort is part of developing what's required to develop emotional regulation so we can be well-adjusted adults that can interact with other people in harmonious ways. When we interrupt that process in our children, it's often because it's really uncomfortable for us to watch them suffer or watch them struggle. And when we have vast resources, we really can throw money at every problem, not realizing that it might be creating problems for our children down the road. So that's one piece of what you mentioned. And the other piece of what you're talking about is this idea of the parents have the dream, they built the business, and then they want to keep it in the family and pass it down. And the second and third generation may have varying levels of interest and desire to be involved in the business. And I think, to me, this really illustrates the point about money values. We all have values around money, and they're often different. And in the example you shared, right, these are parents who have this value of, I really want to provide for my family, I want there to be this legacy. That's their value. Is that the value of their children, the next generation? Maybe, but maybe not. And that's where I feel we sometimes see this. Just a second. That's sometimes where we see this going a bit sideways, is one generation is assuming that the next generation has the same values. And many times they don't. They're different people, and they have a different cultural influences. There's a lot of things that can change from one generation to the next. And so what can be really valuable for families like this is to have conversations around their values. And their advisor or someone else can create a space for them to each talk about what their values are. And they can then appreciate each other's values and realize that collectively, this actually is enriching the family with these different perspectives. And it's okay that we can have different values. That doesn't mean one person is good and one person is bad. It's just different attitudes and values around money.
I totally agree with you on that. I noticed that when you were talking about, this is a little personal, but I always get a little personal with people I like. I noticed that when you're talking about, you know, as a parent, you have children, you had almost a visceral response. Did something come to mind, a story or something that crossed your mind that you might be able to share with us?
Yeah, a couple things. I'm really curious about what makes people tick and why are people the way they are. And I think where this really resonates with me is I often work with people who are the product of wealthy parents throwing money at the problem to solve things. And I see what that does to people. And I see the ways where people can really end up struggling in ways that might be surprising, honestly, and the way it can impact people's ability to regulate their emotions and thus when we're not able to regulate our emotions, life is just a lot more painful and uncomfortable, honestly. And so, honestly, I feel some sadness and sorrow realizing that for a lot of wealthy parents, in their effort to protect their children from pain and discomfort and throwing money at these problems, they are actually creating a life that is likely to be more emotionally uncomfortable than it needs to be. And it's this really just cruel catch 22, if you will, of the way what we want versus how things actually play out.
Yeah, life is terribly unfair in a lot of ways. And that's one of them. I mean, you know, the storybooks tell us if we just make good, we can make the next generation happier and healthier, and they will be grateful and do it again and again and again. But I think any sort of relationship comes with all its complexities. And when you add money to the equation, everything amplifies for whatever reason. I mean, you can say, well, it's just money, but, you know, just money causes a lot of problems. I talk about it being the third person in a relationship. There's you, there's your partner, and there's money. And you each have a relationship with that third person, and it's money. Just give it a name and acknowledge it and figure out what you're going to do to keep it from rearing its ugly head when you don't want it to, and to play nicely with you.
That's a really I really like that approach, actually. Like, that's a really great idea to bring some playfulness and fun to this and take this unspoken thing, the third person in a relationship being money, and make it actually spoken. And I love your idea of give it a name. I don't know. What do you call it? Clementine?
We call it the money monster.
Love that. The money monster.
Yeah.
Right. That then we can have a little humor around it, which humor is something that can make painful topics a little bit easier sometimes. And also it then creates an opportunity for people to shift from seeing their partner as the other or the problem to no, this is the money monster, and we can be aligned as a team corralling the money monster, if you will. So I love that approach that you mentioned.
Well, thanks. I've actually had people write to me and say, my money monster needs an appointment.
I love it.
We'll be sure to share your resources and let people know how they can connect with you and your work. But thank you once again for joining us, Joy.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Joy.
My pleasure.
Francis, can we get your phone number one more time?
Of course. 413-773-3333.
And as always, hugyourmoney.com is a great resource too. Join us again next time for another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Rand.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by
Hug Your Money, it's where you belong. Your future's waiting.